Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today, and welcome to the JSGS Public Lecture, Success and Challenges, Aboriginal and Northern Engagement in Environmental Remediation Projects, presented by Dr. Joe Muldoon from the Saskatchewan Research Council and Vice Chief Joseph Tassani of the Prince Albert Grand Council. The Johnson Shoyama Graduate School of Public Policy is a provincial center for advanced study and research in public policy and administration. The school is a product of a partnership between the University of Regina and the University of Saskatchewan, and it was based on the spirit of cooperation and collaboration, which really represents the heart of Saskatchewan, as well as the lecture today. Not only is Saskatchewan renowned for collaboration, it's also renowned for innovation, and the school is yet another example of this. The combined expertise and resources of the two universities has established the school as a source of respected policy advice and commentary. At this time, I would also like to acknowledge that today's event is taking place on Treaty 4 and Treaty 6 land, as well as the homeland of the Métis. My name is Jennifer Ermentrout, and I'm the Executive Director. I'm the Director of Executive Education at Johnson Shoyama, and I'm the moderator for today's event. As many of you know, our school is based on both campuses, one in Regina and one in Saskatoon, and I would like to extend a warm welcome to our colleagues and the participants up in Saskatoon, as well as Jeremy Rayner. He'll be moderating in Saskatoon. He's giving a little wave. Today, the school is extremely pleased to welcome Dr. Muldoon and Chief Tassani, who will be discussing remediation efforts that took place near the former Gunner mine site, which included consultation with local communities. They'll also suggest on how engaging with Northern and Aboriginal communities can enhance the joint benefits of both of these projects. So today's format for the discussion and lecture, Dr. Muldoon as well as Chief Tassani, they'll be presenting for about 40 minutes. And just as they're presenting, it'll be followed by a Q&A portion of the day. So I just want to pose you with this question. You know, everybody showed up today, everybody chose to come today to listen to this topic, to listen to this lecture. Just think about, what do you want to walk away with? You know, today is all about engagement, and this is going to be your opportunity in the Q&A period to really be part of that engagement. So start thinking about a couple of questions that you want to be able to have answered by these two esteemed gentlemen that are sitting beside me. So what will happen is, for the format for the Q&A, we'll have in Regina, we have two people at the back, and they'll be running with mics so that you'll be able to ask your questions in mics. And then we have Jeremy, who's in Saskatoon, who'll be moderating in Saskatoon. Because we have both campuses, we'll ask one question here in Regina, and then we'll go into Saskatoon and ask a question in Saskatoon and keep going back and forth. So just start thinking about some of those questions that you would like to have answered today. So I'm now really pleased to introduce both of the speakers that I have sitting here. Dr. Joe Muldoon has over 30 years' experience with the provincial and federal government. His current position is Vice President of the Environmental Division at the Saskatchewan Research Council. His background includes regulatory policy and operational applications of environmental and resource management, conflict resolution, mediation, and change management. His education includes a doctorate in public policy with a major in uranium mining, with his Master's of Business Administration and Bachelor of Science in Biology. Dr. Muldoon has been involved in numerous different positions, some of them including Assistant Deputy Minister of the Environmental Management Division at the Saskatchewan Environment, Executive Director of Environmental Protection Branch at the Saskatchewan Government, Senior Manager, Public Involvement and Aboriginal Affairs Branch, and Manager of the Great Lakes Sea Lamprey Program under the auspices of the International Great Lakes Fisheries Commission, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and United States. So as you can see, Dr. Muldoon has a great wealth of experience, both at the very frontline level as well as at the strategic level, that he brings to the lecture today. Vice Chief Joseph Tassani is a member of the Hatchet Lake Dene First Nation. He was elected to the elected to executive of the Prince Albert Grand Council in October 2012 and is currently serving his second term as Athabasca Vice Chief. His position works closely with the communities of Fond du Lac, Black Lake, Hatchet Lake First Nations within the Athabasca Basin of Northern Saskatchewan. Collectively, the Prince Albert Grand Council focuses on the protection and implementation of treaties. They are committed to support member First Nations to achieve independent, progressive self-governments and to improve quality of life for their members through social and economic strategies that are relevant to each community's needs and their assets. So I just, you know, both of these gentlemen have such a wealth of knowledge today on this topic. So I want to make sure that you're getting everything that you came for today out of this lecture. So I really want you to join me in welcoming both Dr. Muldoon and Vice Chief Dasani this morning.
Well, good morning. Thanks for that great introduction. As mentioned, I'm Joe Muldoon. And when Kathy talked about, I was over in her offices, Kathy McNutt from the Johnson Shoyama School, several months ago, and I was talking about the Project Cleans and some of the work that we were doing. And Kathy said, why don't you come and talk about some of that work? And what I said, first thing that came to my mind was, well, what I'd really like is if I could bring somebody like the vice chief in to really co-present. And thankfully the vice chief agreed, because it's I think his input and his presentation is really going to be the highlight here this morning more than anybody, because I really want to acknowledge the vice chief for taking the time to come down and spend the time with us. He's got a really, really busy schedule. So I'll start with that. What we're going to do is I'm going to start and do a number of slides just very quickly on the Project Cleans itself, just to kind of give you the perspective and the background, and then we'll get into the how we have done our what I call joint engagement activities and how we conducted those and just some of the results and some of our experiences. So it's kind of sharing our experiences with you, mine from the SRC side and the vice chief from the community side. So it's not telling you what to do, it's telling you what we experienced and what we did. And then you can kind of take that, and what I'm really interested in, of course, is the questions and the discussion. I think will be really helpful when we're done here. So I talked about our collective experiences and learnings from our joint engagement. And I mentioned joint engagement and the key word being joint, because for engagement to be real, it's not one way. It's really, more than anything, it's listening. And it's not taking your program and saying, here's what we want to do, what do you think? It's, we want to develop a program, how do we build that together? What are your needs? Here's our needs, what are your needs, and how do we make this work? So that's really, in essence, what we want to talk about this morning. The presentation, I know where the policy school is in a sense sponsoring this, it's really going to be more operational based than policy think. But retrospective, in terms of looking backwards at what we've done and some of the challenges and some of the wins that we've had. So really, we are going to be discussing policy and then that program progression that comes with that, in a sense, policy review. This presentation will be successful from my perspective if, in conclusion, you feel that the policies that we're talking about, in particular the duty to consult, really acts as a guideline or even really minimal requirements. And if we really choose to stretch beyond those guidelines or that policy, then the benefits will outweigh the efforts that we take. So that's what I want to achieve today in terms of coming out the other end of this. The way we're going to format the presentation is I'll present some slides. I talk about the front end ones. And then the vice chief will kind of go back and forth with slides. We'll ask a few questions. And that's just for us to try and have, in a sense, a discussion with you along with the presentation, giving you the information that we need. Vice chief, you can do the summary there.
Okay. Thanks for the opportunity here. And want to acknowledge the Treaty 4 land that we're here on. I want to thank the students and everybody, you know, in Saskatoon and here for attending as well. I'll just go through the brief summary, the presentation that we're going to be doing. We'll do a brief introduction to SRC remediation program and associate engagement activities. What is engagement and why it is important, what it entails, barriers and aids, experiences, highlights with communities, questions and discussions. So Joe.
Okay, so I'm going to, as I said, very, very quickly go through kind of the Gunner project and very quickly about SRC. So SRC, we're a Treasury Board Crown, 350 to 400 employees, give or take it. We always go up and down depending on the markets. We do work all over the world, about 1,900 clients all over the world. We focus primarily on mining and minerals, energy, biotechnology, development engineering, and then forestry and environmental support across the sectors. As I said, we're government-owned, but we're really an arm's length Crown Corporation. Most of our revenues come from fee-for-service. About 25% of our revenues, it depends on the year, about, give or take, 25% of our revenues come from government. So we really are, we've got a foot in the private door, and we've got a foot in the government door, which is a nice place to be at times. Majority of our work is directed to the mining industry, and then obviously we do work for government as well. So the Project Cleans is a project where the funds that were allocated, they were allocated to clean up 35 mines in northern Saskatchewan, 35 legacy uranium mine sites, two big ones, Gunner and Laredo. And it's funded by the governments of Saskatchewan and Canada. We are under contract to the provincial government to deliver the project on behalf of both governments. Just one other comment with respect to that contract. In the contract itself, there's language there that says, that speaks to the direction for SRC to try and utilize the project to boost economic and capacity within the communities that we're working within. So there's a nice language in the contract as well. I'm going to leave it at that because I want to move through these fairly quickly. So it's a small slide, but if you look on the bottom right corner, you'll see that little red star way up in the northwest. That's where Project Cleans takes place. It's way up in Lake Athabasca. It's quite an isolated area. It's accessible by boat, winter ice, road, and air. So lots of logistical issues and concerns in terms of dealing with the sites. Here's a picture of the Laredo Mill remediation project. This is a project that we just finished. It was a three-year cleanup, and it was at a cost of about $28 million. So the reason I mentioned the dollars is there's a lot of money involved in cleaning up these kinds of sites, lots of opportunities to be able to not misspend that money, but to spend that money in a smart way in terms of making sure that we keep those benefits within Saskatchewan, and in particular within the northern communities as much as we can. The lake in the background here, I can't help but do a little bit of science here. The lake in the background of this picture was treated in situ, bringing the pH. When we first came out of the site, the pH was around between 3 and 4, which won't sustain any kind of aquatic life. And we brought it with over about a 12-month period, brought the pH up to over 7. So it's now that lake will now sustain fish and all the aquatics that go with it. So a really interesting project. We're now in the maintenance and monitoring stage of this project. We just finished it last year. Here's an aerial picture of the Gunner mine site. This is the largest uranium legacy site in Saskatchewan, and I would suggest in Western Canada, and probably one of the largest in Canada, period. It was operated between 1955 and 63. And during those years, there was a mining community located on site, totally isolated, only in by, as I said, by air or winter roads. They had the school, a mall, multiple residences, and obviously the full production facilities for the mine. So upwards of 700 people, 700, 800 people on the site, living full-time, 12 months a year. The site components, there's a large open pit, over 100 meters deep, two large waste rock piles, 4.4 million tons of tailings spread over three separate areas, and totaling 70 hectares in terms of that tailings. So, and large piles of mine site debris that are currently there. In 2011 and 12, there was all of the original buildings were still on site. In fact, when I first went on site, you could go into the buildings and you'd think that people put their coffee cups down on the desks that they were working and walked off the site, because that's really what the site was in terms of remediation. It was left basically as is. And if you read back through the history, that when the uranium market crashed and the U.S. was no longer buying uranium, all of those mines closed down. And a lot of people lost their shirts, lost their houses, and everything in between. Northern communities that were depending on that economic activity, it all just dropped. So quite a situation. The major work on, I'll go back to Gunnar, a little side note there. The major work on this site is beginning this year, doing the tailings remediation up on site. And again, that tailings remediation project is well more worth than the $28 million spent on the mining site, and that's strictly the tailings. So it gives you an idea of the scope of dollars that we're going to be spending. It'll certainly be well over $100 million that we'll be spending up at Gunnar mine site in terms of the cleanup. Now to the main topic, I just want to give you that background so you have an idea in terms of the project and how it fits into the project. So what the Vice Chief and I here are going to do is we just want to share some of our experiences I mentioned earlier. And the way that we started into this project back in, we got one of the contracts in 06 and the Laredo contract in 08, so it wasn't that many years ago. And there's 33 satellites, very small, what we call Ma and Pa operations, were very smaller sites that supplied ore to the bigger sites during those years, those 50s and early 60s. And many of these, again, those satellite sites were left untouched and not very safe in terms of open holes and waste rock and all sorts of things on site, very close to the communities in northern Saskatchewan up in that area. So the first thing that we did before we had a plan, before we did anything, we went out to the communities first and said, here's what we're here about, here's what we're charged to do. We've got all these mines to clean up, we've got these satellites, they're probably, what do you want to start to clean up first? The satellite sites from a public safety side are probably front and center. Which ones do you want to do first? And we had a series of meetings across the north. And that kind of signaled that we were wanting to hear before we did, and that we didn't have plans in place and said, okay, what do you think of these plans? So we built those plans as much as we could together. The big bold on my notes here is the journey was as important as the destination. And it was really the journey that really counted in terms of how we move through these kinds of processes. So the idea was to build trust, two-way trust, and communication. We wanted to identify our needs and barriers. What was the project scope? What did we have to do? What decision-making authority did we have to retain? How could we share and make sure that the communities could get what they needed as much as we could provide as well? So I'm going to leave it. Let's see. The only other comment I'll make on this one is one of the big questions we have with the communities was around who was going to make the decisions on the remediation on the contracts. And because we were contracted by government, because they were open processes, transparent processes, we said to the communities, we have to retain the final decision-making authority on who gets the contracts, because that's a core part of our job. But in our discussions with the communities, what we then, and we had a very standard procurement, just like everybody else. So then we sat down with the communities, we said, okay, well, we need to open up the procurement process. We need to make sure the communities not only understand it, but they're part of it, and so that they can not only participate, they also can direct it from the front end. So what we did was we opened up the procurement process, and we had a regional rep from the communities that the vice chief would appoint, and they would sign a confidentiality agreement, and they would come in and sit as a decision maker on the procurement committee. and that would be for multi-million dollar contracts. I can remember going to our purchasing group and indicating that we were going to do this. And they said, no, you can't, that's never been done, we can't do that. And I said, well, we've committed to it, and yeah, we can. So that's what we did. And what it did was it brought that wealth of knowledge in, it brought that trust, and it was really a great way to start the project. It also serves as a really strong message to the contractors that we're serious about what we do. So when contractors come in to bid on the contracts, they know that we want and have to have communities involved and economic development happening at the communities. Vice Chief, I've got a couple of questions for you that I wanted to get in, and then the Vice Chief will get into his discussion. I'd love for you to comment on the procurement process and how did it work for you, having a local rep in the decision-making role on procurement. How did that work?
I think, Joe, the opportunity for our people to be at the table at any decision level table is very important, especially I stress this to SRC and to companies that go into our territory, into our lands, that, you know, when you make those decisions, it only makes sense to have our own people making those decisions, so we can all be accountable at the end of the day if something were to happen. So when the opportunity came around, working with SRC, and we wanted to make sure that, you know, those decisions that are being made over our lands only make sense to have somebody that's from the area that has, we made sure that the person that we selected knew the community, knew some of the grassroots, knew some of the challenges, knew some of the technical stuff that's needed in terms of going through the contracts and all the documents that had to be reviewed. So I think it was a good way of starting that the relationship building, because, you know, we want to make sure when we select a contractor, they do what they say they're going to do with the community. Because a lot of times we've experienced companies or individuals going into a community and with little engagement with the leadership or the people in the community. So people remember that, and if you leave a bad taste, you know, they'll remember that. And it not only hurts the contractor, but the next contractor, it could be totally different, you know, exploration company, it could be road building contractor, but you'll get labeled. You know, it makes things harder when you don't leave a good legacy. So I think, you know, we feel like we're part of the decision-making process. I think that is very important, and especially over our lands. And when we have people, our people sitting at the table, we just don't want to be there because we're an Aboriginal group or just because, right? We want to make sure that those decisions are made together. And it's not just a token representative that we have to include, you know. You have to truly mean it and be genuine about that. So I think that relationship and making sure you do as best as you can to accommodate and make people feel welcome when you're making those decisions. And again, at the end of the day, we can all be accountable for the decisions that we make.
And I guess another question that's kind of, I think, permeate through the whole presentation, Vice Chief, is about the whole engagement processes to date, and most importantly, how can we improve them? How can we move this forward? So that's kind of there as well in terms of as you get into your presentation.
Okay, so we'll talk about engagement, and you know, look at if I were to go into your backyard or go into your homeland and start doing something where I'm going to be making money or benefiting or making millions of dollars, and how would you want to be part of that process? You know, if you're getting your backyard redone, you know, you just don't hire somebody and they'll do whatever they want to do, and you have little input. So I think building that trust and making sure, you know, that when we do the, when you apply those engagements with First Nations communities, that they feel connected. You know, that, again, you know, making those decisions together and building that trust with that individual or company going into your backyard. So, you know, when you need to learn about where the community comes from, you know the history, you hear a lot about treaty rights and all these things about treaties, and maybe learn about the treaties and where the community has come from. You know, especially the northern communities, our people lived off the land for thousands of years, and just recently, 60 years ago, it was my grandpa and my dad was actually born out on the trap line or out in the bush. And so you have to, it's good to know the history so you can make those connections and build those relationships, you know, with the individual. So make sure, so the two-way street is, you know, what do they want? When somebody goes into a community, what do they want? And what does the community, what are some of the needs? You know, so make sure you have some sort of, you know, give and take and the mutual benefits for both parties. And, you know, especially when it's in your backyard, it's not just somewhere, it's in your backyard. So planning, joint planning, you know, with the process here with the Gunner stuff, there's been, you know, we've been planning from the beginning. So it kind of makes you feel like you have some influences in decision making, and, you know, when you're planning with leadership as well too, and it's good to understand the tree or the organization, how it works, because you know, at the tribal council level or at the federation, at the province level, they can offer you support in making sure that you make proper contacts, because sometimes you might not get the people in the community that you need to talk to, and making sure that you get set off in the right direction. And I think at the tribal council level, I think that's what we provided, was making sure, you know, working with SRC, that, you know, they talk to the right people and making sure you talk to the right elders and the right community contacts. And I think it's worked, and the process, I think it just makes things a little bit easier to handle. And the long term too, and something that I wanted to talk about is what are some of the things that, you know, that's going to be left behind for our people, and how do you keep that relationship long term? Because again, it's important, because it's going to be your backyard. You're working in your backyard. You're going to be stuck there, and it's our backyard. That legacy, whatever you do, it's going to be in our lands, and where our people travel and hunt. That's their grocery store. So it's very important the long term people understand what the long term goals are, and making sure if you do leave that, you know, they have a sense of direction where they need to go. So. The levels of decisions, I think, you know, you have, when you go into a community, especially into some of the northern communities, you have your local leadership. You almost have to look at it, you know, different, not different, but, you know, the community, the leadership there, they make the rules. They say what can happen and what cannot happen. And I think when you make those decisions together, you know, at the different levels, that we can all be accountable, and the leadership and the community feel like, you know, that they have some pull and some direction, a sense of direction where this is going. So I think that's about it there, Joe. Okay. If there's anything else.
Okay. Yeah, we'll keep on rolling.
Okay.
Going to talk a little bit here in terms of the slide. There's the messaging there, and I'm not going to cover the slides exactly, as you've probably already figured out. But what I will do is I want to talk about the duty to consult as it relates, because, I mean, that's, in a sense, people think that's the driver, and it is to a degree, but that's what I want to kind of talk around. That's where the real discussion is, and The duty to consult with Aboriginal people, there's a duty to consult on those that will be impacted by the project under consideration. So this comes right out of the policy. The duty applies if the project has the potential to impact treaty and Aboriginal rights, such as the right to hunt, fish, and trap for food, or the gathering of plants for food, medicinal, or ceremonial purposes. So governments are responsible for delivering that. And they will then ask the proponents, if you're talking about a project, they'll ask for those project proponents to engage during the project planning and before the regulatory approval is given to say if you follow the duty to consult. So that's kind of, I guess, what I'd call the goalposts in terms of duty to consult. And I'm not going to cover in a whole bunch of detail there. Saskatchewan has a policy framework, and we have the processes in place. And it's a base, and it's a good base. And there's nothing wrong with it, and I'm certainly not being critical of it in any way, shape, or form. I guess what I want to share, what I want to suggest, is that it's really a minimum requirement. And there's so much more that needs to be done and can be done, and as we've demonstrated, can be done. And we're not the only ones, but I mean, ours is the one example we put to you today. And, you know, where you can create project efficiencies, things that the work that we've done with the Prince Albert Grand Council and the FSIN and the various First Nations and the Métis communities and the Northern communities as well. I mean, all of those pieces, we've been able to find efficiencies that we'd never find otherwise. Because just from a logistics side, if we didn't work in that fashion, you know that we're not going to have a project that's really going to work the way that it should. And what we've found by far is that the benefits far outweigh the cost and the efforts. We have a full-time Aboriginal liaison person in our group. That's a group of 18 people that does the remediation work for the council. There's lots of other work around through the council that supports it. One of those is full-time, strictly Aboriginal, and they're in everything. They're in every meetings, that particular person. And I'll talk a little bit about how that's changed the culture in the organization as well here in a minute. So, again, in bold here, I've got engagement should not be considered a process. It's not something that, Mark Collette, one of our guys that works for, he just says it's not a check. You don't check the box off when you've done the duty. It's building a relationship, and if you're building a relationship, that doesn't end. And there's ups and there's downs, and we've had lots of crises where we've had to do this or do that, and we've always. That first point is, how's this going to impact? Well, how can we do this? Let's call the vice chief. Let's call one of the chiefs. Let's find out how we're going to fix this. So I'm really talking about taking a specific policy, and this is the policy piece that we got to bring into this, right? And it really is important. Kathy would probably hit me right now if you could see me. But it's really moving beyond the policy, moving beyond the words. And it's the intent. So it's not the language, it's the intent of the policy, what it's really supposed to mean. So that's really what we want to do. Another question to you, Vice Chief. What do you think about the duty to consult, where we are now and where we need to go?
Okay. Thanks, Joe. We've been talking about duty to consult a lot of times recently. What does that mean? Dealing with Saskatchewan Research Council, dealing with the province, you deal with the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, everybody has their own policy of what that means and what is the duty to consult. Dealing with some of our trappers in the north and, when, let's say there's a drilling or exploration company going into your trap line and next to there's bulldozers coming out of the bush in the middle of nowhere, and I think it's important that people, not just to consult, just for the sake of going into community and just trying to cover, the duty to consult requirement. You go into a community, you talk to the leadership, and you go above and beyond what's needed in terms of consulting the communities. I think if they feel like they have some honesty and making decisions, and you know, we do have policies and new guidelines, and sometimes you need to bend those policies and making sure they're adjusted adequately in terms of the needs that you have in the north, because, you know, it's, I think the duty to consult and to accommodate, that's another gray area, I think, just dealing with, you know, yes, the trappers do get consulted, but how do you accommodate? What are you doing in terms of accommodating what is required? Because if the trapper's going in there, let's say a drilling company is going into your trap line and they're making all sorts of noise and they depend on the fur and the animals and for their food, for clothing, or to sell or make some money. But if you have noise in your trap line, there won't be any animals for you to trap or any animals for you to hunt so you can feed your family. So what are you doing in terms of compensating and accommodating? Not just in terms of money, but it could be jobs, it could be gas, or because, you know, I think that accommodating duty to consult, yeah, consult your leadership. Not only the leadership, consult the trapper, the individual that's out there, and making sure that you do the best you can. But again, too, by working with the Tribal Council or the First Nations or the Federation, that, you know, we can send you in the right direction, making sure that you talk to the right people and consult the right people. And sometimes you might have to go out on the land or into a community or and it takes challenges, it, you know, when you go into some of these communities. So that's my take on duty to consult. And, you know, at the Tribal Council and FSIN level, they have their own versions of what duty to consult is for First Nations within, just in general, within the province. And if you look at the community, they might have their own duty to consult and what they want you to consult them on. So I leave it there, Joe.
Okay, and you're...
So I think some of the forms that we do want to talk about, you know, open forms and presentations. We have an open forum. Sometimes we have band meetings, a community meeting where you go in and have your community meetings. And within our Tribal Council, we have our sectors. We call the far northern sectors, the Athabasca sector. We have a sector meeting. And those are other forms of... And having, if you do want to go into a community, that's a great opportunity to let the people and as a region to notify them what you're planning to do. So I think talking about workshops, another form of is the workshops that we do is specifically sometimes. I think it's on the slide here about translating, you know, when you have workshops, specifically sometimes a small thing that you need to talk about in terms of some of the technical stuff, you almost have to tell a story in terms of our people so our people understand what it is. Let's say tailings, if you're talking about tailings or radiation, you almost have to tell a story of what radiation is for people to understand. So having those workshops is very important, not just in the community. Sometimes, you know, we come into Saskatoon or Regina, bringing people out and showing them where SRC or Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission and all these things, what they are, and the communities. It's good for the community members to learn about the organization as well. So. Workshops one-on-one, I think those are, one-on-one is probably one of the best ones, because I think sitting down with an elder and maybe with a translator and or even Joe and some the staff will come into our office and just have a one-on-one conversation of, what do you think? This is what we're doing. This is the contractor. What do you think about the contractor? What's the relationship? How has it been? Is there anything that you want to, you know, flag, or, and it works both ways too. And, you know, if the Research Council, if they have something, they share it with us, and we try to work together to come up with the best solution. So one-on-ones are pretty good. Feedback, nowadays we have technology, we have Facebook. I know some staff of the SRC, they have Facebook. I think SRC has a Facebook as well too, and technology, emails, phones. I think that's very important to, you know, it could be just a quick text. Can you call me? Can we set up a meeting? Yeah, so continual feedback is really important. Language and translation, that's a challenge because, again, when you're talking about radiation or tailings, that, you know, the language and making sure that the translation and making sure that you take enough time for people when you're translating some of these technical things, that you take enough time that, you know, you do proper translation, because it makes things harder when you start setting people off in the wrong direction and they think they understood this was going to happen here, this is what your intentions were. So I think it makes things harder if you don't have good translation for some of the language barriers that we have. It's not, I shouldn't say language barriers, but our people, even our dogs still understand the Dene language in northern Saskatchewan, you know. In some communities you see our kids don't speak our language, they're, you know. But back home, if you tell a dog to go outside in your language, the dog will go outside, or, you know, they still understand the language. So it's something positive. So media in some of the communities, we do have some newspapers. Again, Facebook is pretty good. A lot of our people have their own Facebook page, community advertisement pages, newspapers, radios. And I think, and to use elders and some of their traditional protocols too, and some of the communities do offer tobacco and stuff like that when you go into a community. Some of our northern communities, it's good to offer food, maybe a meal to try and get people to come out, and I think, and to utilize the elders, not just for prayers and that, to utilize the, in terms of the traditional knowledge and in terms of the land that we occupy, so. Is there anything else, Stuart John?
No, that covers that one. Just on the meetings and tours. One comment I just make on the elders when you talk about that is when we did the tailings work up at Laredo, and then we had to do the vegetation cover on top of it. And what we did is we had an elders workshop and brought in translators. And of course, the elders we had met with them a number of times before. I actually had them come and tell us what should we be planting. And again, we had to, in terms of goalposts, in terms of what would work in a sense of you can't plant trees, those kinds of things on the tailings, but what were some of the plants that would make sense and that would survive up there, and then from their own traditional use, what would make sense. So the elders told us what to and gave us the kinds of plants that we should plant, and it was their decision, wasn't ours, and we took that, and that's exactly what we did up at the Laredo site, and that's what we'll do at the Gunner site and any other sites that we deal with. So if you've
just on the next slide there, you know, just the forms and some of the consultation process, I guess, that we did is we try to move people around, you know. It's good to try to adjust the interest, and just working with the research council is how do we try to make it fun and not so it's we go there, that we just sit in the boardroom and that we make it might be boring for some of the people and not really be engaged. So we try to get them out. It's good to see firsthand what we're talking about, so they can see the tailings, the waste rock, and some of the things, you know, the buildings that are out there. It's good to see that. And you know, the meetings that we have here in Saskatoon or in Regina or in Prince Albert, we bring them together and learn about the projects, and continual, right? And that's what it was about, to making sure that we're all on the same page, and there needs to be some major decisions that we bring people together. And I think too is to making sure that, you know, when we invite people, that we just don't pick people just because they have nothing to do or just watching hockey at home, or, you know, we want to make sure that people that we engage do have an interest. And, you know, they have some value, and that, you know, they give us some feedback, I think. So those are some of the forms that, you know, in terms of looking, checking out the plants and going out into the to the land and learning about some of the plants. And yeah, those are some of the...
That's great. If there's one piece of advice that I can provide in terms of the forms and so on is don't use any one form. Don't depend on any one form because they will get stale. And the people, they get so familiar with what they're saying, it doesn't always go back. And so you've always got to have that mix. You'll continually capture new interest. And you'll learn, when you capture new interest, then you learn new things. And then that's where that relationship, and you build new relationships. And then you're not dependent on any one or any three or four relationships with somebody in a community. The whole community knows who you are, and you know who the whole community is. And you've gone out and you've gone into the communities, and you've gone out and on the land with them as well. So there's you can't want to depend on any one
form.
So if you want to do the barriers.
So some of the barriers into community engagement, it could be timing. When you're planning something and before going into a community, you need to know what time of the year that's in. In July, a lot of our people go on their pilgrimage. They go, most of the time, they spend their time out on the land, setting up fish camps. They'll be out on the lake. And some people go on religious trips into sometimes different countries or different provinces, or out on the land again. So timing is very important. Sometimes they do a lot of festivals. Communities come together. It could be a time of hunting. In the fall time, they could be hunting moose. Winter time, they'd be out hunting caribou. So timing is very important. And also isolation. Some of our communities are only, like in the winter time, the only road access would be on ice roads. Some of the communities are not all season roads. So isolation is, you have to take that into consideration, because sometimes when you fly into a community, let's say there's bad weather, low ceiling, you can't fly out of the community for like 3-4 days. And it happened just yesterday. There was a snowstorm going into back home where my sister called and said, yeah, plane hasn't landed for the last 2 days. I can't see across the lake here. There's been lots of snow. So some of the isolation challenges that are out there, let's say you're setting up a meeting and you needed a part or you needed a new laptop or a memory stick. If you're isolated, you won't be able to get some of these things because if it's, depending on the weather and transportation-wise too. So priorities, I want to talk about some of the leadership. Coming from a northern community, there are a lot of challenges. A lot of the times, almost every day, the local leadership are putting out fires in the community. Let's say they're dealing with water treatment plant, some of our communities on boiler advisory, low housing shortages in the communities, all sorts of different challenges, building ice roads, making sure that you have people out there, making sure there's fuel in the community. A lot of times when you go and try to engage a community, you might have a hard time in terms of just even a simple meeting, the one-on-one that we sometimes do. And sometimes Joe said, yeah, we can't get a hold of the chief. They're out there. They say they were going to be here, but they're out at a different meeting. And we still try to not to discourage Joe, but I tell him they're busy trying to tackle something else. Can we try something else in terms of engagement? Maybe open up the hall at the community level and maybe talk to some people and try to get a sense of direction. So it doesn't mean your request or what you're trying to do is not important, but some of the needs that, at the community level, they might get preoccupied. So I think, and a lot of the times too, like I said, some of our First Nations are not as wealthy, and sometimes it's hard for them to organize a meeting because sometimes you might have to cook, somebody has to cook the food and get the food. If it's traditional meal, somebody has to go hunting, get the gas, get the ammo from PA or Saskatoon or Regina or, so So sometimes you might have to help a little bit to try and alleviate some of the stress and maybe help out with some with the food, the cost of the food or whatever, right? So I think those are some of the things. So I think a lot of our communities, like I said earlier, you know, they have we all have different experiences. But a lot of the times the negative experience, a lot of the people remember some of the negative things that has happened. So, you know, it's only good, you know, when you take the time to know the community and engage the community in a positive way. You know, when you don't get that meeting that you're requesting, don't go back and start pounding the chief or the local leadership or the community. You know, take the time and maybe offer some advice, and maybe it's something that you can help the community with, and maybe offer that. So I think if you take that route, I think it'd be good. Another thing is be prepared before going into a community. Talk to, like I said, the tribal council. Talk to people that you know that have worked in the area. What are some of the challenges? So the more you're prepared before you go into a community, I think it'll be better. And talk to people and make sure that you have somebody with you. When Joe, we were lobbying for this project because I think the government has been kind of taking their sweet time in terms of getting our backyards cleaned up. And we went together. We lobbied together, you know, we make sure that, you know, that what they say they're going to do, they fulfill those things that they said they were going to do for our people. So I think be prepared, go together, and you know, I think at the end of the day we can all be accountable, like I said earlier, for the decisions that we make. So things change. Have a backup plan, a 2-3 day backup plan sometimes, you know. But that's all I have, Joe.
No, that's great. Thanks, Chief. I'm going to zip through these pretty quick. Because we just almost in summary, you know, you got to have the capacity, you got to be transparent, open and transparent, honest. You got to be patient, as the Vice Chief talked about. I spent more than one day in fogged in locations in northern Saskatchewan lots of times. And the employee engagement, I've just very quickly, that if your own employees, if your own people that you're working with, they buy into this because it's so real. I mean, it's real. You see the benefits, and you see the relationship, and the people that you work with, they see that, and they buy into it. So when we talk about engagement, it's not just a thing that you're giving out. It's something that you're gaining internally as well. We've seen a huge change in SRC in terms of how we do business across the board, because what a great learning, what a great way to understand that to build external relationships, you have to be able to build internal ones. And it's been huge from an employee engagement side for us, and that is important. And
community engagement, the willingness to listen, to learn about a community is very important. Our people have been living off the land for generations, not to say that, you know, we still live out in a bush and in tents, but we do live in modern communities and housing. We have internet and we don't live in igloos or anything like that anymore, but our people had a choice. They probably would prefer to be out there off the land, and they still enjoy that. I live in just south, north of Christopher Lake, and but I had to go home. My dad was born out on the land, so we are connected to the land. If I don't go back out there, eat the fish or drink the water, that I don't feel grounded. So it's important to know the traditional knowledge of the community and to try and understand where people come from. So, and you know, and you have to be genuine and true, and not just because you need something from a community. You know, you engage, you want to learn and how to make things better for everybody.
Okay, I'm going to just go right there. Do you want? This is the Vice Chief. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. dead on, too.
So, yeah, I don't have anything else there, Joe.
Okay.
There's any questions?
We've got two very quick videos. You gotta have something to, I know you, it's been a long presentation, and I appreciate your patience. It's like two minute videos. One on the Aboriginal Mentorship Program that we have at SRC, and then one on the Gunner tour itself. It kind of brings it all to ground real quick.